Hey y'all, it's Dr. Samina Rahman, Gyno Girl. I'm a board-certified gynecologist, a clinical assistant professor of OBGYN at Northwestern Feinberg School of Medicine, and owner of a private practice for almost a decade that specializes in menopause and sexual medicine. I'm a South Asian American Muslim woman who is here to empower, educate, and help you advocate for health issues that have been stigmatized, shamed, and perhaps even prevented you from living your best life. I'm better than your best girlfriend and more open than most of your doctors. I'm here to educate so you can advocate. Welcome to Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. Let's go. Hey, y'all, it's me, Dr. Samina Rahman, Gyno Girl. Welcome to another episode of Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. Today, I am going to introduce you to someone that I met recently, and she is amazing and cool and brilliant. And so before I do that, I want to just reintroduce myself. I'm Dr. Samina Rahman. I'm a board-certified gynecologist, a menopause and sexual medicine expert in Chicago. I have my own private practice, and I'm converting to a concierge model this summer with Ms. Medicine. I'm also working on a book that I'm going to hopefully get to you guys soon. It's called Brown Girls Disease, A Guide to Sexual Health and Empowerment Through a South Asian Lens. So stay tuned to that. But I finished this interview and we finally did it, even though we have different time zones. But I finally got to interview someone I'm a big fan of. And I got to meet her in Dallas, and we're going to talk about that. But it's Dr. Louise Newsom. She's a physician, a woman's hormone specialist, and a member of the UK government menopause task force. She is an award-winning doctor, educator, and author committed to increasing awareness and knowledge of perimenopause and menopause. She's described as the medic who kickstarted the menopause revolution. She has empowered a generation of women to have greater understanding, choice, and control over their treatment, bodies, and mind. I mean, she is on tour. I mean, her accolades just go on and on. But she is studied medicine and pathology at the University of Manchester and pursued a career in hospital medicine before moving to specialize in general practice and medical writing. She's a member of the Royal College of Physicians, a fellow of the Royal College of GPs, visiting fellow for Murray Edwards College, Cambridge University, and has been awarded an honorary doctorate in health from Bradford University. She's a founder of a podcast called Balance. It's an amazing podcast. She also has a Balance Menopause website with a lot of free education, which is amazing. She has, in 2018, she started the Newsom Health, which is a clinic in response to difficulties many women experience in obtaining perimenopause and menopause treatment. Newsom Health clinicians provide individualized consultations to women across UK with a holistic approach to treatment. So she has that, and it's amazing. And she has done a lot in academics. She publishes a lot. It goes on and on. If you don't know her, you better recognize. So just take a listen. You'll learn something, I'm sure. And she's just brilliant, compassionate, and just a lovely individual. So let's get at it. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. I'm Dr. Samina Rahman, and I'm super excited to have a world-renowned leader in menopause join us today. Dr. Louise Newsom, welcome to Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. So excited to have you.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for inviting me. It's great to be here.
I'm so excited. But Louise and I met recently. I mean, we've been like, you know, friendly with each other online for a while, but like we met recently in Dallas, and she's just as pleasant in person as she is online. So she's real. Everything you see is real.
So. Yeah. Do you know what? I'm too old to pretend that I'm something different or someone different. It's just not worth it.
But, you know, in my intro, you guys heard about this remarkable things that Louise has been doing in the UK and really around the world. It's become, we like to call it in this menopause sidetrack that we have. It's like a movement of like women empowering each other during this midlife transition. Louise, you want to share anything about how you brought yourself, you came into this movement?
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Because I was never expected. Like, if we'd met each other 10 years ago, I would have said, do you know what? I'm quite tired of being a family physician. I can't imagine doing it forever because it's exhausting. I don't feel like making a big impact to my patients. I enjoy medical education and medical writing, but I haven't really found like what really ignites me and makes me want to get up in the morning. I'm just doing a job, really.
Yeah.
But if you had said to me, oh, you know what, you'll be doing menopause, I would have just laughed and said, don't be ridiculous,
that sounds
actually.
amazing.
But and now, look what's happened. And I think I'm a really honest person, and I'm also a very inquisitive person, and I'm also a very scientific person. So I ask a lot of questions, and I've done it throughout my medical career. Mm-hmm. If I can't work out why a treatment is working or not working, or why guidelines say something, I will always go back to the original evidence and try and work it out for myself. And once I realize the massive injustice that's happening and is still happening, that's happened for decades for women being denied hormones, and then thinking about how our hormones just work naturally in our body, and then feeling really cross, actually, as a doctor that no one taught me. Mm-hmm. My medical clinical practice would have been very different the last 25, 30 years, like lots of ours would, right? Yeah. And so, but I also, because I'm honest, I want to share what I know with other people. And I've, rightly or wrongly, some people think wrongly, I've shared it a lot in a very vocal way, mm-hmm. using sort of, you know, tools that we didn't have before.
Yeah.
So, you know, social media is important, but also publications, doing research is really important. Working with others is really important, because I think a lot of times in medicine, there's a lot of power struggles going on, especially when different research groups or different departments. And so medicine can be quite toxic, actually. Mm-hmm. And I don't have an agenda, as many of your listeners hopefully know. I don't work with any pharmaceutical companies. I don't work with any brands. You know, my mission is to just improve the health of as many women as possible and allowing them to have choice about their future health. And so the more I do, the more I expose myself, the more horrendous stories I hear, actually. And now it's not just menopause, it's hormones throughout. No. You know, I see a lot of women with PMDD, increasingly postnatal depression. And no one is joining the dots and thinking about hormones. And I just don't get it. I sometimes feel like I'm living in a parallel world. You know?
Absolutely. Don't you? Like, I feel the same way. And I think that, you know, social media has this great benefit of being able to connect with others, but it also puts you under fire a lot, right? Mm. Like, you know, you've unfortunately been under fire for some ridiculous stuff. Even though you are, you know, educating the masses, a lot of it for free, and you're publishing articles based on the thousands of women you see a year in your practice, in your very large practice. And so I find that to be, you know, I guess it's just part of, people say that's just part of being, like, when you start becoming a little more well-known for something, that you go under fire.
Yeah, but we didn't go into medicine, you know, we didn't go into medicine to have all these fights. It's, you know, the bigger picture of it, you know, is why is it so hard for women to get hormones, and why is it so easy for women to be given antidepressants, you know, or if you think of the urinary symptoms, why is it so hard to even get some vaginal hormones?
Yeah.
Yet anybody can get antibiotics time and time again for cystitis. Like, it doesn't really add up, does it?
Yeah. It's something about the hormone and the stigmas and you know, this gatekeeping that happens. I agree with you. Well, let's talk a little bit. I mean, you mentioned mood disruption a little bit. I think that that's a very, for me in my practice, I feel like that's probably one of the biggest reasons that and just sleep disruption. Those two factors are so critical. People don't feel like themselves in perimenopause. It's such a roller coaster with the estrogen. Let's speak a little bit to, you know, the statistics around that and whether or not, you know, and I always say, like, hormones aren't the, like, silver bullet that's going to solve anything, everything, but it's part of the toolbox that we have to consider. And so, you know, let's talk a little bit about the hormone issues around mood disruption and perimenopause.
Yeah. And I think it's great you brought it up. It's really important to think about basic, like, what hormones are. So when I'm talking about hormones, I'm not talking about hormone treatment. I'm talking about hormones we have in our body. They're just biologically active chemicals, if you like, that our body makes. They are natural messengers that go from different tissues and organs, and they go in our bloodstream, and they affect every single cell in our body. And so I think it's really important if we understand the role of hormones in our brains, because for decades, nearly a century since the hormones were discovered, it's always been about these hormones from our ovaries. And of course, they are come from our ovaries. They go in our bloodstream and go everywhere, but they're also made in our brain as well. And a lot of doctors still don't realize that. When something is made in an organ, it's because it's needed in that organ. And so we have different cell types in our brain, but they all respond to estradiol, progesterone, and testosterone. And many people will know we have different regions, areas in our brain that have different roles. So there are areas of in our brain that determine our personality, our memory, our mood, our sleep, our temperature control, our digestion, our metabolism, our breathing rate, our heart rate. Like, our brains are so important. And then when you look at how do these nerves work, how do the messages go from one part of the brain to another? How does the metabolism of our brain work? Then they were all determined by different hormones and neurotransmitters. But estradiol, progesterone, and testosterone are neurotransmitters. They help these chemical impulses that go from one place of the brain to another. And then I think it's easy then, because once you understand that, then you think, right, so if I don't have those hormones stimulating other neurotransmitters, helping the brain regenerate its nerves and the cells, then of course I'm not going to sleep very well. Of course my mood's going to be affected.
Yeah.
But what's happened for so long, actually, is that menopause has been said, it's just something that happens to women and it's a few hot flushes and sweats. Yeah. And of course people can get flushes and sweats, but it's not the most common symptom. The most common symptoms are symptoms affecting our mood, our memory, our sleep, like you say. But women have, and they still are, just gaslit and told, oh, it's because you're stressed, because you're tired, because you're this. Yes, of course. But actually, let's think about hormones. And I'm really keen to even take it further and not even really talk about menopause. Let's think, has this woman got a progesterone deficiency?
Yeah.
Has she got an estradiol deficiency?
Yeah.
Or does she have a testosterone deficiency?
Yeah.
Because I see a lot of people in my clinic who are young, they're in their 20s. They're having regular periods, but the few days before their periods, they can't get off the couch.
Yeah.
They're really tired. They're really fatigued. They're quite irritable. Mm-hmm. They're finding it hard to go to work. And their period comes and they feel fine. So these people have got premenstrual syndrome, or some of them when they're more severe symptoms of premenstrual dysphoric disorder, PMDD. But a lot of those women are still producing hormones, they're still having regular periods, but they're really just a little bit low in progesterone and often quite low in testosterone.
Yeah.
So we need to think of them as different hormones having different effects in our body. And the problem is it's been sort of lumped together really as menopause.
Yeah.
So then women think, well, if I'm still having my periods, then it can't be a hormonal issue.
Right.
And of course it can.
Right.
And I think that's what we're all doing differently to other generations of doctors, is that we are educating women.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't, we've both got two roles, haven't we? We're healthcare professionals, but we're also patients as well.
Yeah.
And so I feel cheated as a menopausal woman that I probably spent about 10 years of my life being testosterone deficient.
Yeah.
And I had no idea it was related to my hormones. I just thought, oh, I've had my third child.
Yeah.
I can't cope. I'm tired. I'm irritable. I'm losing everything. I can't remember anything. I can't sleep.
Yeah.
And it was only when I had testosterone back, I'm like, wow, my brain is back. This is how it used to be in my 20s and 30s.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I feel cheated. I feel robbed as a woman that I struggled, you know, and it was, everything was like wading through treacle, and now it's easier.
Yeah.
So it's not fair that I've got knowledge as a patient and a healthcare practitioner that we can't share with others. And that's what we're doing differently, I suppose.
And I think it's interesting because we have, you know, the privilege of like being in the system and we understand it, and we still have struggled and we still have had our own, you know, because, you know, people always, you know, talk in the big ivory towers to follow the guidelines and all the things. But the reality is we're deficient in the amount of research that we've done on women, right? Like, 1993 was the first time in the U.S. that women were allowed in research.
Yeah, I mean, to be in study.
It's really, no, otherwise we're small men or we're mice. Like, what? Like, right?
Well, it's, but isn't this, I think this discussion is though so interesting because, you know, I qualified as a doctor in 1994. So everything that I studied at medical school was based on men.
Right.
So the statins, the blood pressure treatments, the painkillers, antibiotics, male studies.
Yeah.
But then somehow in 2025, when we talk about testosterone, we've got so many people saying, no, there's not enough studies in women. We can't use the male studies.
Yeah.
And it's like, hang on, we've used the male studies for every single other medication. Why is it suddenly, because it suits various people's agenda, yeah, we can't look at the male testosterone because it's the same hormone, yeah, just different levels. You know, it's just...
It's gender studies, right? Like you,
yeah, totally.
You have absolutely X person that you're transitioning,
yeah,
with high super physiologic doses of testosterone. So you know what the consequences can be.
Yeah.
And we try not to be super physiologic. We want to keep it physiologic, but... Yeah, it's very interesting.
And the same way with estrogen, you know, some people who are transitioning have very high doses of oral estrogen and they don't have the clots, they don't have the sort of side effects or risk that others talk about. So it's very incongruous. It doesn't really add up. And I think it's just all about trying to control women in the wrong way, really. And it's just sort of thinking beyond symptoms, you know, I'm a physician, I'm not a gynecologist, and I'm very interested in preventing disease. And so when we think about these hormonal changes, because they're so important for the way our cells work, we know that our cells, our bodies, our tissues, organs don't work as well without those hormones. And so these risk of conditions, really common conditions like cardiovascular disease, so heart attacks, raised blood pressure, strokes, but dementia, type 2 diabetes, different cancers, osteoporosis, mental health conditions, like you say, like even psychosis and kidney disease, these all increase without hormones. And this is something we need to even shout louder about because we're living so much longer as women. You know, 100 years ago, we didn't live quite so long, so it didn't really matter.
Right.
But, you know, none of us really, if we can avoid it, we don't really want to spend the last 10 years of our life in a care home.
Yeah.
We don't want to have osteoporosis of our spines. We don't want to be dependent on others,
mm-hmm,
you know. And so we all work really hard with exercise and nutrition and, you know, looking at what else we can do.
And other things, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, obsessively going to doctors, measuring our blood pressures, making sure we're not hypertensive, having medication for that. But somehow the health risks of untreated hormone deficiency seem to be lost on people?
Yes, absolutely. And I think what's interesting is even looking at, like, you know, the hard and fast rules we had around starting it with age and other things. I mean, you look at someone like, you know, Caitlyn Jenner, who's like, you know, older and started like high doses of estrogen, you know, to transition in the other way. And so, you know, like you have to, And you know, we all have patients who are like, you're going to pry these hormones out of my dead cold hands, right? Because they
don't
on it. And so we know there's some hard stops for some patients, but like the reality is, you know, everyone deserves a conversation around it.
Yeah, definitely. We see a lot of older women in our clinic and they're actually usually mothers of our patients who say, do you know what? I've missed out on this because of that WHI study. Can I try it? And people often concerned when it's more than 10 years because they looking at the WHI data, which is a synthetic preparation, very, very different to natural hormones. So we often give the natural estradiol, the natural progesterone, the natural testosterone in low doses and transform women's lives. A lot of women who've got a bit of cognitive decline, maybe some muscle weakness, they've started to use Zimmerfrain, you know, they can get rid of those. They can feel better. They sleep better. You know, if we sleep better, that's really good for our future health. If we can build muscle, that's going to be better for our future health. So you can visibly see these women, like, wake up and then their last 10 years is transformational. And for us to look at old data and say this window of opportunity, we can only have it and we'll start it when we're under 60, makes no physiological sense at all.
Absolutely. And I feel like, you know, that's the patient population I'm starting to see more of too, where it's like, wait, what about me? Like, I got missed out.
Yeah.
And so we have nuanced conversations. And then sometimes I have to talk to the internists that are involved and we kind of like try to negotiate something if they're good candidates and if it looks like it's going to be beneficial to them. So, but it's worth looking at, right? It's worth looking at for all these
people. For sure. You know, even if you just look at preventing osteoporosis, because osteoporosis is so common when we age without hormones. You know, there are lots, the drugs that are otherwise given to treat and prevent osteoporosis are highly toxic. They're far more toxic in the cardiovascular system than even synthetic hormones, actually.
Yeah.
So we have to be, and this is where, you know, as clinicians, we should be involving our patients. You know, I'm sure you're the same. Every consultation I have is different.
Mm-hmm.
People have different concerns. They have different worries, they have different beliefs. And patients are quite used to dealing with uncertainty.
Yeah.
You know, we buy cars and we don't have a randomized control study telling us that this car's safe and this one isn't. You know, we make choices that are right for us. And I think that's what's happened since the WHI is women have been left out of the conversation.
Yeah.
And it's the doctors are deciding whether they are allowed or not allowed. You know, the number of times I've spoken to women, they say, oh, no, my doctor won't allow me to have hormones. Like, is it their decision? Do they know how you're feeling? You know, we can't do this as doctors. You know, I really feel we're there as advocates for our patients. We can share our knowledge and uncertainty and choice really with patients.
Right. Absolutely. And I feel like that's kind of where it's different for us that are now treating patients, like trying to remove the patriarchal way we've learned. Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I think I was always like, well, you put your big girl panties on today. So let's talk about whether or not this is something that, you know, is good for you from a medical perspective, but you have to tell us how you feel. And then, you know, I believe you. I believe you when you tell me that that's how you feel.
Absolutely. I think that's so important. And I learned that very early on as a junior doctor. You must listen to your patients. You must believe your patients. And, you know, the number of women I see in the clinic who are told, my doctor has told me my joint pain can't be due to my hormones. And it's like, well, I have no idea whether it is or isn't. But I can tell you, let's give you hormones and see if it helps.
Right.
I cannot, we can never categorically say something to patients. And I think that's a shame because it's not fair on the patient. They don't know where else to go and who to talk to.
Absolutely. Oh, speaking of joint pain, I saw your abstract at Ishwish. There were two that you presented, I think, or that was presented on your behalf, because I know you're in Australia doing great things. But one of them was around musculoskeletal syndrome and menopause and using a combination of estradiol, progesterone, and testosterone versus just estradiol and progesterone. Is that right? Do you want to talk
I mean, it's what we see a lot in the clinic all the time, actually. But what we would do, because we collect symptom data on our patients, so we were looking at our patients and seeing if symptoms of muscle and joint pain improve with standard, if you like, HRT, which is estradiol and progesterone, and we tend to prescribe the natural through the skin estradiol and the natural progesterone, and then adding in testosterone as well. And the addition of testosterone made a big difference to women, but any type of hormone actually did. And we know that, you know, musculoskeletal symptoms are incredibly common. And these hormones work as anti-inflammatory agents in our muscles and joints. So it's no surprise, but it's very important to share that data and show people this improvement in symptoms.
Right. And even the other abstract, I think, was around patients who had chronic pain and were on opioids, I think. And
So we do a lot of de-prescribing, and so we've presented that data. We've presented other data recently, actually, in EMAS in Valencia in Spain, showing that women on opioids with antidepressants as well, we can reduce their prescribing by around 38% or so, especially when we add in testosterone as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, testosterone is very important in our brain. And the problem is, as you know, a lot of the guidelines will only talk about libido. And don't get me wrong, libido is very important. Of course it is for lots of people, and we always talk about that.
Yeah.
But, you know, you're not going to have a libido if you're not sleeping, if you can't concentrate, if you've got joint pain, if you're feeling tired, if you're feeling low and irritable.
Yeah.
And testosterone can really help with those symptoms as well. And so this data was showing that when we add in testosterone as well to HRT, we can deprescribe. And more data that we're presenting. And it seems a bit weird, doesn't it, as a doctor saying we want people to come off medication.
Yeah.
But actually, it's really important. You know, antidepressants are not as safe as we first thought when they came out.
Yeah.
They're addictive. They increase risk of osteoporosis, for example. So coming off those drugs can be really good for people. Mm-hmm. And antipsychotics and painkillers, you know. And it's more of a problem for people, I think, in the US, but it's pretty bad over here.
Yeah.
Or, you know, these drugs are highly addictive, you know, and they're not without risks. And people get them very easily. And we know chronic pain is a real problem. It's a real drain on resources, and it's very so much more common in women, and we've got to be thinking about hormones.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, for so many women, their pain's never been really taken seriously, right? Like, you can look at the statistics on medical bias, medical racism when it comes to, you know, how we look at pain differently in different sexes and in different races. And I feel like, you know, when you have this sort of, we call it epistemic injustice, where you're taken seriously, where your story isn't taken, you know, as something that is true, then it really builds a problem for women. And so just by allowing them to understand that this is something that we take seriously, that this is something that we are going to, you know, we believe you if you're in pain, and but we're not going to just try to treat it with opioids. We're going to try to understand why and what's happening. And so I think that's very important. Because, you know, opioids, if you think about it, really, like, if you look at your brain, too, as the biggest sexual organ, like, opioids really are inhibitory when it comes to sexual function also.
Of course they are. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And that's so important. And also, you know, the way that pain is, you know, the way that pain is perceived by people with that on hormones or not, we've known for many years. And I'm very interested in, you know, the modulation of our pain receptors with hormones. Even if you just look at some of the data showing that women who have PMS, for example, before their periods, they are more likely to feel pain from the same stimulus than after.
Yeah.
And the only difference is that they've got more hormones on board. And our hormones will stimulate the opioid receptor. They'll still help with the pain pathways. Whereas most pain consultants, most doctors and specialists who deal with pain will never prescribe hormones.
Yes.
So they'll never see the results either.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
The women don't know to ask, of course, then they take all these painkillers with lots of side effects.
Yeah. I'm just so glad we got a name to it last year with Vaughn doing her naming it the musculoskeletal syndrome menopause. I think it gives a little more validity to some people when they see this symptomatology. So. And so what do you think, Louise, is on the horizon for, you know, women, you know, in the midlife when it comes to, do you think there's new things we should be considering hormone-wise? Or I know that there's some pessaries that you've been involved with as well, so, you know, in terms of some of what I've seen.
Yeah,
in your-
I think thinking about these three hormones separately is very, very important. We need to be talking about that more. I think we can't be ignoring the vagina and the urinary tract symptoms. And around a fifth, a quarter of women who take systemic hormones still need vaginal hormones. And I think this is an area that it's probably not spoken about enough, but actually crucially important. So we've got vaginal estrogen, we've got estradiol and estriol, two different types of estrogen that have been available for a long time as vaginal pessaries, creams, gels, so forth. But we've got prastrone, and you've had it in the US a lot longer than we've had it in the UK.
And I love it, yeah.
For those that don't
I
know,
out, like,
yeah, yeah, so prastrone is DHEA, so it converts to estrogen and testosterone in the vagina, the pelvic floor, the surrounding tissues, the urinary tract. And I personally find it transformational for women.
Absolutely.
I don't prescribe vaginal estrogen anymore.
I don't either. I always go with prastrone first.
Yeah. And, you know, and I'm speaking as a patient as well, who's had lots of urinary tract infections. I've had pyelonephritis. I've had cystitis where it's been horrendous. Like, so horrendous, it's awful. And it's mad because I'm married to a urologist and he's watched me in pain. He's watched me, like, doubled over. And there's something about urinary tract infection. You're just, your eyes are watering, your toes are curling.
Yeah.
You get these shivers and rigors, and it's just horrid. And most of us have had them.
Yes.
And never once for the last 30 years did I think about my vagina and giving myself vaginal hormones. And it was only after a hysterectomy that really floored my bladder that I just thought, I've got to try something, because I was on all these antibiotics, feeling really poorly, had a catheter in for 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And then I just thought, actually, I'm just going to try some prastrone because I you know, give it to my patients. So I got a doctor to prescribe it for me. And it's revolutionized just my life. I don't want to speak too soon, but I haven't had a urinary tract infection for so long. I don't even remember. I used to carry antibiotics with me because I was, the sooner I take them, the better.
Yeah.
But I see that in my patients, those people that have interstitial cystitis, painful bladder syndrome, they've had recurrent urinary tract infection, they've had lichen sclerosis, they've had awful, you know, localized symptoms, they've had painful, painful sex where they've avoided it for so long. And prasterone is incredible. And it makes sense, again, like if you go back to why you're giving it,
yes. Well,
we've got receptors for estradiol and testosterone everywhere.
Vagina.
And a lot more testosterone androgen receptors in various parts of our anatomy. So yeah. Why would we not replace,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I think that was like just really revolutionary even for me to realize for, you know, when I was studying with Ishwish and when I spent some time with Dr. Goldstein and Erwin Goldstein, and it was, wow, you know, like this is something that totally missed the boat on for so many patients. Postpartum patients, right? The lactation issues that are just like menopause, you know. When
And women on contraception as well, because, you know, that's the other thing that I'm spending a lot of time on over the next few months, really, is I'm picking a lot of evidence. Some of it's quite bad, actually, about synthetic hormones and what they do to women.
Yeah.
But also, we know that they're more likely to have urinary tract symptoms because their hormones are being blocked by synthetic hormones.
Yes.
So allowing women to think about having vaginal hormones, because, you know, urinary tract infections are you know, they're a big inconvenience. Like I say, they cause a lot of pain and distress, but they also cause death.
Yes.
You know, about 30% of sepsis is due to urosepsis, urinary tract infections, especially as women age.
Yeah.
And we can't ignore that.
And I think what the statistic is, like 6% of those women die, you know, from UTIs.
Yeah. Yeah, it's high. Yeah. So
estrogen and DHEA are life-saving for so many patients.
Yeah. And that's where, you know, Rachel Rubin's work is phenomenally good, because she uses such big data sets. You can't ignore the numbers, and you can't ignore basic physiology. You know, if we're told a drug works and has good results, but you can't quite work out why the drug works, I'm always a bit skeptical, especially if it's been funded by the pharma industry. But this is basic physiology. You're just replacing like with like, and it works. And so great. And it's safe. And it's also safe in women who've had breast cancer. And that's important too.
That's very important. Yeah. It's safer across the board. So I think that's wonderful. And so what's coming up for you? I know you went on tour last year too, right? You had a little tour going on.
I did. Yeah, that was fun, actually. It was good. I talked a lot about the history of hormones as well. So some shocking stats. So I'm doing 3 small tour dates in October, and then I'm going on another tour next year, actually. I'm going to hit the road and go and speak to some more people. So that would be good. And I'm doing quite a lot of writing, quite a lot of researching. Yeah. We've got more publications coming out. We've had 2 this in the last week, but we've got some more academic research coming out. Our education program that's already global for healthcare professionals, we're relaunching it in the next few months. So it's going to be even better. So we've got a lot of stuff going on, actually, which is good.
Yeah. I mean, I always say that for people, I'll say, well, how can we improve the situation? It's like, we have to teach the clinicians who have been practicing for the last 20 years under the false pretenses of the WHI, right? So that's a big healthcare gap. I can teach residents now and I can teach students, but the patients, people that are on the ground right now, they have to be retaught so much of metabolism. Yeah. And so we'll put all your links in the show notes and everything. But I want to be cognizant every time. I'm so glad that we got to speak today.
It's been great. Thank you.
Yeah, and we could go on forever, but I'll be cognizant of your time. And thank you for me today, Dr. Louise Newsome from UK. And I hope that we get to see each other. Are you coming to the US? Anytime soon?
I've got some plans, so hopefully we can link up, definitely.
Okay. All right, nice. Thanks for joining me today, guys, for Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. I'm Dr. Samina Rahman. Remember, I'm here to educate so you can advocate for yourself. Please join me on my next episode.
If you have a second, please subscribe to this podcast. I'd love for you to be a follower and learn as much as you can about the things that we're going to talk about with all the people on our journey. Please review us on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. These reviews really help. Review us, comment, tell me what else you want to hear to get more information. My practice website is www.cgcchicago.com. My website for Gyno Girl is www.gynogirltv.com. My Instagram is Gyno Girl, so please follow me for some good content. Additionally, I have a YouTube channel, Gyno Girl TV, where I love to talk about all these things on YouTube. And please subscribe to my newsletter, Gyno Girl News, which will be available on my website. I will see you next time.